Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about stress-induced brain fog. We're joined by Dr. Jill Weber. Jill is the author of Overcoming Stress-Induced Brain Fog. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice in Washington, D.C., working with people managing varying degrees of anxiety. She is the author of Be Calm, writes a blog for Psychology Today, and has appeared as a psychology expert in USA Today, The Washington Post, and on CNN. Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Brain fog is something that's really talked about a lot. Can you talk about what exactly it is?
Well, the way I think about brain fog is really just kind of a matter of degrees and maybe how you know yourself, that you sort of realize at some point, or maybe through, you know, maybe listening to this podcast, you recognize that you're no longer able to focus, remember, or be present at your usual capacity. And for some people, maybe they've never really felt like they could focus at a level that would be helpful to them. But many, many people with brain fog, if not most, have had periods where they felt pretty grounded and pretty able to focus, generally organized. And then, you know, as a result of kind of chronic stress over time, they're not able to do that.
So how is the stress-induced brain fog different from mental fog caused by other medical conditions?
Well, the stress-induced brain fog is not the result of a medical condition like COVID, long-term COVID, or Alzheimer's, or some other kind of neurological condition. The difference is that it's more the result of something going on in your environment. And in that sense, you know, it's very hopeful because there are things you can do, you know, with deliberate action to reduce that stress and to kind of find yourself again.
Are there different ways it shows up with stress-based?
With stress-based, I mean, a lot of folks I talk to, and maybe you can relate to this, I think most people can, particularly with going through COVID and, you know, 24-hour news cycles and phones and all this immediacy, but it can just be like this sense of feeling spaced out, not fully there. There's also a sense of kind of like dread. A lot of people I work with, I would say over the past couple of years in particular, just talk about dread, and sometimes they don't even know why they wake up with this like heavy feeling on their chest and like, like what's the day got in store for me? It's just kind of walking on eggshells, feeling dread and numbing out a lot. You know, once you get through your tasks and check off some boxes that you just kind of numb out on the phone or TV or that type of thing.
And how does chronic stress impact your brain?
I mean, if you think about the body's fight or flight response, which probably a lot of people listening to this are already familiar with, it's really normal and evolutionarily advantageous that we have it. You know, there's a stressor in our environment, and our nervous system kind of activates this response. You know, the sympathetic nervous system activates this response where we focus on that stressor and do whatever we need to survive the situation. So there could be, you know, a snake on the hiking trail, your digestion's going to slow down, you're going to be really hypervigilant and immediately focused on, you know, getting out of that situation. And then fairly quickly, the parasympathetic nervous system activates and kind of brings your physiological arousal back down to baseline. And that's really very normal. But like in modern times, what happens for most of us at times is that, you know, pretty much benign stressors are activating this kind of visceral reaction in our bodies. And when that's happening enough, we're not really returning to that baseline. We're just kind of existing in this chronic fight or flight, which means those stress hormones like cortisol is a great example, or adrenaline, are running on some level all the time, maybe not at a 10, but, you know, maybe it's like kind of like a 4 or 5, and then something really stressful does happen, like you get into a car accident or you're going through a divorce or whatever. And before you're really, it's really easy to just stay at a full tilt at that point. So the idea of stress-induced brain fog is that you're kind of living in a chronic fight or flight on some level, and that your body's not able to return to baseline. And over time, this, you know, impacts memory, learning, your ability to be present. And there is real research, you know, that when we're in a stressed out state of mind, we're not really able to take in new information as we are when we're in a calmer place.
That makes a lot of sense. And I feel like a lot of people can probably relate to this now. And I think maybe it's just me, but it feels like there's more of a self-awareness about this brain fog people are experiencing. What are some ways that people can start to understand their stress response?
I do feel like, particularly with COVID and like this, you know, massive timeout in a lot of people's lives, that that many are wanting more peace, you know, and are really interested in that idea. I think we kind of see what matters and how finite life can be, you know, and wanting to have a more peaceful sort of sense of well-being. So if you're listening to this right now, probably a part of you has that instinct already, which is really healthy. And you know, the next step is to build that awareness, you know, kind of, if you can, maybe even after listening to this or reading my book, even just to kind of sit down and like take an inventory of yourself. And I usually encourage, just to build that self-awareness, I encourage people to really just start with like thinking about how much they're sleeping, how restful is their sleep, or are they feeling like they need to sleep all the time? Recognizing how often you're forgetting something, how often you feel like you're behind the eight ball, that you're, a lot of people describe feeling like they're always catching up, like, huh, what? And maybe they're able to do it and, you know, accomplish what they need to, but it's very stressful to feel like you're always late, so to speak, you know, in your brain. Recognizing how often you're spacing out or daydreaming, kind of just not really sure where you are, not present. Recognizing your energy level, like if you're feeling sluggish a lot of the day. I think I might have already said, but your distractibility, you know, how much you're able to take in what's going on around you. Because as I said, new learning is really difficult when we're in a stressed out state of mind. And then looking at kind of your exercise, you know, most of us should be at least walking, you know, every day, getting outside, you know, are you doing things like that? Are you drinking water during the day? And then a really important piece of it, and I think that we so easily kind of zone this out because we just get so used to our bodies, but is how much tension you're carrying in your body. You know, do you have back aches? Do you have stomach aches? Do you feel like your heart's sort of beating at a higher pitch all the time? Headaches, physical tension. So trying to tune into the things I've just listed, really through sitting with yourself and maybe even writing a couple thoughts down, but really trying to take in how your body is, because it's so easy for us to just completely separate from our bodies, right? And just be little brains functioning in the world. And that is a real big part of how we get burned out.
Yeah, when you were talking about the in your brain always feeling late, that's really terrible for someone like me who's type A. And I totally just related to that when you said that.
Yeah, yeah. And even if you're not actually late, but just feeling that way, like, oh God, I missed this email or I'm behind on this or mm-hmm. that. You know, it kind of makes you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And you talked about this or alluded to it briefly, but in your book, you call it chronic survival mode. Can you talk a little bit more about what that is?
Chronic survival mode is this idea. And as I said earlier, I think for a lot of people with brain fog, they are very high functioning. They've had periods in their life where they've done fine. I mean, nobody's perfect, but usually have had relationship success, professional success of some sort. So over time, it's like, they're still able to check the boxes that they need to in their life, but it's really like a high pitch. You know, maybe they're drinking coffee all day, you know, not getting a lot of sleep, and just, and they may appear very, you know, fine to the outside observer, but internally their body is full of tension. Their heart's beating fast. They feel sick. Like, oh God, what did I miss? What am I doing? You know, subsisting on, but as I said, maybe caffeine or these high energy drinks, and then at night having some wine or something to take off the edge, not getting enough sleep, and kind of just like starting that all over again, that kind of groundhog day, as I say in the book, existence. So it's as complicated because actually they're still functioning and doing what they need to do. And so it's easy again to kind of ignore the body and the impact on the body. But over time it can lead to, you know, other symptoms. So that's chronic survival mode. You know, you're swimming upstream and sure you got your head afloat, but darn, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. And over time, everybody has a limit. You know, at some point, something's going to give.
Definitely. And you mentioned earlier spacing out. Why is that a common response to stress? And what could spacing out look like for someone?
Yeah. If anyone listening just, you know, thinks about a stressful time in your life, you know, let's say you've got a medical condition or a family member with a medical condition, or you're even moving or, you know, anything, you know, all your attention's on that, you know, and your brain's like, oh, well, let me go through my list. What do I need to do? As I was saying, we really minimize the toll that takes on our bodies to be at such a high tilt for such a long period of time. So when that stressor maybe is reduced, perhaps we leave the hospital where our loved one is, or we're done with the really stressful work meeting, or the divorce is finally over, or whatever, then the brain's like, oh, like I can't, like you just kind of like flatline, you know, like I can't think about anything. I'm sure most people listening have had that experience. But when you have a chronic stress over and over again, then you're kind of pinballing back and forth between managing the stress in the moment, their survival mode, and then flipping to kind of just like numbing out or spacing out. What does that look like? A lot of folks I talk to would tell me, I don't even know what I was just thinking about. So sometimes it's just legit kind of in your head, like the gears are just churning and you're not even really aware of it, which is one of the remedies is to start paying attention to what you're thinking about. Or it can be daydreaming and, you know, fantasizing, you know, daydreaming about something or wishing for something. It also can be replaying negative experiences, because when we're so burned out, you know, that the brain's negativity bias, our tendency to remember the negative more than the positive, is evolutionarily wired in there. So we're really susceptible and vulnerable to doing that when we're burned out. But wherever you are, when you're spaced out, you're not in the here and now. So once again, you're not encoding what's going on around you. And that's another reason why you're feeling always behind.
Could scrolling be a way of spacing out, the mindless scrolling?
Absolutely, Cassie. I mean, we've all had that experience. Like why did I just waste, you know, X amount of time doing that? And, you know, the research shows that scrolling, clicking releases like, you know, a hit of dopamine in the brain. Even though it's nothing, like mm-hmm. we're opening the weather app or, you know, we're checking something random. It just, you know, but just the act of doing that gives us a hit. So this is, you know, particularly powerful with things like social media, right? Where you're actually looking at imagery and all that. It just kind of keeps your brain like mesmerized. But when you're finished, you feel empty. You don't feel recharged or rejuvenated on any level. In fact, you feel more foggy.
Yes, I have no experience with that whatsoever.
Right, no, me either.
In your book, you write about learned helplessness. Can you talk about that and how it comes into play with brain fog?
If you think about that chronic stress idea, right? Like if that plays out, and people vary. I mean, some folks go through something difficult and they go through chronic stress and then they get it together. And hopefully many people listening now are going to do that, you know. But the longer this thing plays out, the more, again, going back to the treading water analogy, right? Like over time, even the strongest, you know, treading that water are going to be like, oh my God, what am I doing? What's the point of this? Like, I can't go on, you know, you just start to feel like I can't get ahead. And that's when it really gets intense, because with brain fog, because it's easy to start to give up, you know, you begin to feel like not only are you not driving the car, but it's impossible to drive the car, you know, the car being life. So life starts to steer you and you accept that and you just kind of feel like a victim to it. And I say that respecting that there are lots of situations, like horrible situations that people go through that are really hard to not kind of give into, really hard to not give into. And there are situations where we are victims and it's hard to even look for our control. And that's when it's really important to maybe talk to a therapist or a trusted friend and try to see ways to protect yourself and feel more empowered. But learned helplessness does set in when time goes on and you can't make any inroads. And then you start to feel like, you're kind of at the mercy of your circumstances. And some, as I said, gotta say, sometimes we really are, but by and large, finding places that you can feel a modicum of control can be really helpful, even if it's only 10 minutes of breathing, you know, and sitting with your heartbeat. Certainly not enough for a lot of situations, but it's something. And it's something to make a person feel a little more in charge of their life.
This feels like it goes along with what you call the self-pity trap. Can you talk about that? And what are some ways that people can start to identify things that are actually in their control?
Well, the self-pity trap is similar to what I was saying, like where if you start to think about it too long, you know, and I certainly, you know, I think anybody can understand these feelings, right? Like the suffering that goes on, you know, and all the suffering we can see in the world, right? It's really hard to not just start to feel awful, just really awful about yourself or your life or your situation. But the thing is, then that kind of turns into damaging and hurting yourself, you know, and it's not always conscious, but it just kind of happens subtly. You know, you feel like you can't get a grip. You feel really awful about yourself. You sort of start to give up on maybe exercise or eating enough or drinking enough water, or whatever, you know, and over time, you know, it compounds the stress. Internal versus external, we call this locus of control in psychology, which means that there really are some things that are out of our control. Maybe the financial circumstances, how safe your environment is, you know, certain things, financial situations, but looking at everything as outside of your control is like a worldview, which we'd call that an external locus of control. That's how we get into this self-pity trap or the learned helplessness, where we feel like we're at the mercy. So the way to shift that is to try to develop more of an internal locus of control. So I can't control everything. Absolutely not. And there are factors and forces way greater than us. But the internal locus of control tries to hone in more on, well, what can I control, right? Like, man, it's raining out, it's awful out, and I have this, you know, I have to do something outdoors. We can't control the rain, but we can wear a raincoat. We can focus on the good food at the event or talking to somebody that we enjoy talking to. So trying to focus on the things that you can control to make the environment a little bit better for yourself. And things that generally we can try to look at are like our health behaviors, you know, trying to take a walk, trying to get outside, trying to breathe. Our self-worth, our peace of mind, our nutrition, how we deal with ourselves. So like I was talking about earlier, how much we beat ourselves up for our circumstances versus trying to look at it in a more self-compassionate way, because, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive, but the, you know, this has been said many times, but the more compassion we have for ourselves, the more likely we are to do things that are good for us. Your sense of joy, your mood, your pleasure. These are things that you can't perfectly control, but you could start to hone in on more. So instead of just checking boxes, which is what often happens with the situation of brain fog, people's survival mode, get through the day, they forget about all these other things, their joy, their pleasure, their sleep, their ability to connect with people. So being able to like kind of shift over to that and not just focus on checking boxes paradoxically makes people feel more in control. So brain fog tells us, no, I just need to get through the day. I need to accomplish, succeed, manage people, and then I'll be okay. But of course, it's elusive. That peace never comes, because we all know, intellectually, we know that's not really how it works. And right now, if you're listening, try to shift off to those other things, those more qualitative states of mind versus just accomplishing and making people think you have it together.
What you're talking about now seems to be something regarding retraining your brain. Can you say more about that? And how does someone start to do this?
Absolutely, Cassie. Yeah, that fits in perfectly. I mean, it's in sort of like getting out of brain fog in general, like so many things is about retraining the brain. And, you know, the exciting thing is, you know, neuroscience is demonstrating that we really can, that there's actually tangible evidence that neurons kind of wire together, so to speak. And that's been a theory for a long time of Donald Hebb, that, you know, the more we do something over and over again repeatedly, that gets wired in on a neuronal level. And evidence has certainly shown that over time, that we have this neuronal plasticity. So the more we do something, the more likely it is to become a habit. And that gets literally sewed into the fabric of the brain. The problem with that, though, is, you know, when we've done something a certain way for long enough, it feels really hard. And certainly as we get older and certain habits take hold, it feels hard. So it means we have to deliberately act and do things that are difficult initially, but it will take hold, you know, if you're willing to do it. It's just like, you know, the common example is going to the gym. No one really wants to go to the gym after they haven't gone for a while. But even after that first visit, most everyone says, oh, I'm glad I did that. I feel a little better. You do it again, you do it again, you do it again. Oh, you fall off the wagon for a few weeks. You just got to get back on that wagon. But you do that deliberate action enough, it's going to kind of change the wiring. And eventually it will become more automatic.
I was going to say, it's so interesting because it feels like the negative habits wire into your brain so easily and unconsciously. And then you have to deliberately counteract that with those positive habits. Like, I've said to multiple people, like pre-pandemic, I used to be a person who went to a 6 a.m. spin class. I literally got out of my bed, drove at 5:30, went to class. And now, you know, I have a bike, a room across from mine, and I can't even get on it at 6 a.m. now.
I totally hear you. It's right. It's harder. right? It's harder. But when you were in that zone, you were really in it. It sounds like, like it became just kind of a part of your life. And that is the hard part, is to get out of one zone and into the other. Although people tend to overestimate how hard that is, and they underestimate how hard it is to live not doing it, if that makes any sense. Because like, if you went over on that bike, even for a half hour today, you would immediately start to change that pattern. You'd be like, oh my God, right? It's like that easy in a way. Like if it only took an hour to not have to feel bad about that anymore and think about it that way anymore, it's certainly worth it. You know, we downplay like how hard it is to how much we beat ourselves up for what we're not doing.
Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzle, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com. You talked about it a bit earlier about detaching from your body. Why is that a common symptom of stress-induced brain fog?
Yeah, I mean, it is such a common symptom, probably just in our culture in general, I guess, you know, with so many ailments that I see in my practice as a psychologist. It's like, it's just so easy to just become a brain, you know, a doing body that's just doing things, and to divorce ourselves from our body. And, you know, some of that has to do with the way our nervous systems are. But of course, we always pay the toll one way or the other. And it's almost like the body becomes unnecessary. Like, why would I spend my time doing that? That's a waste of time when I've got all this other stuff and all these other stressful things to do. I mean, it's really natural and understandable, you know? And back to that deliberate action to be like, no. And I'm sure listening to this, people are like, of course we know we can't do that. We know our body needs to be attended to in a myriad of ways. But it's just really easy to get into that automatic behavior. But like the example with the bike in the other room, tuning into your body has immediate rewards. It really does. And there are ways to do that that I outline in the book. Some people are afraid to do that. You know, if it's gone on long enough, you're like, oh God, I don't really want to like feel my feelings or feel all those weird sensations we have in our bodies, you know, not always pleasant, of course. But there are ways to do that that don't overwhelm a person. You know, mindfulness is probably the number one best way to do that. You know, just downloading an app right now and doing it for 5 minutes. But the point is, if you do that, you will feel the rewards very quickly. You really will. I mean, any day I do mindfulness meditation, you know, I'm not saying it's like an enormous difference, but it's there. It's definitely a change where you just feel this little connection between your brain and your body, and that you can kind of keep going back to it. Because we have to, as they say, wake up and remember that connection over and over again.
One thing you write about is social connection. Can you talk about why this is important and how it impacts the brain?
A good way to look at it is we all would see like babies and parents, right? It's almost like immediately when a baby comes out of the womb in an ideal situation, they're bonding and attaching to their caregivers very quickly through cuddling and snuggling and eating and all these different things. And it's very obvious to anyone in a situation like that, that we kind of come wired into the universe with all these attachment needs. I mean, we're pretty vulnerable and helpless, right? I mean, unlike some animals, it takes a while for a human infant to be able to be safe and turn into a child that can do more, be safe on their own. So it's like the need for attachment and connection is present, you know, from conception on, really. And that goes on into adulthood. I mean, of course, it's not on the same level, but it's all part of, as a child, how our brain wires properly, how we learn to self-regulate, how we learn to manage our emotions, how we feel like we matter and exist. You know, without that, you could just feel like you're like, you know, just floating in outer space. But in adulthood, and certainly with brain fog, it's easy to think, you know, I don't really need all that. I got enough going on here. Or a lot of people tell me like, people are a pain. I don't like people. I think it's just like, okay, I'm not, you know, you might not like people, but you probably got to learn to like people. Sometimes that's just a defense of not wanting to have to feel vulnerable with people, because real connection means we're vulnerable. So the brain needs human connection, you know, initially in childhood, just to wire properly and neuronally. And in adulthood, it goes on, you know. I mean, there's some really, really compelling research on how having healthy connections in our 50s leads to being happier in our 80s, and even to being medically healthier in our 80s. You know, you just think of an elderly person who loses a spouse, and then they fall into some kind of dementia, or they're not functioning as well as they used to. I mean, if you think about these examples in your own life, it's pretty obvious that human connection is essential. So when a person gets into brain fog and they're treading water, it's easy to say, I don't need that. And yeah, this isn't always conscious. You just don't make so much small talk with your neighbors anymore. Maybe you're around people, but you're not really like present. You know, you kind of just sort of pat people on the head like, yeah, great, But you're not really sharing yourself. And you do that because you don't feel like you have the resources or the energy, or you're afraid to be vulnerable. But over time, this is just another thing that impacts your stress response, because relationships break up our stress. You know, one good conversation with a friend where you feel understood, most people are like, whoa, wow, I'm so glad I did that. I feel better. I mean, that's sort of the whole premise of psychotherapy. You go in and relieve yourself of your burdens and talk for 50 minutes, most everyone feels better afterwards, or they feel like, okay, I have started something now that I think will help me. Yeah. Human connection is essential. And the more we isolate, and there's extreme examples of this where people don't even leave their homes or aren't talking to many people at all, only a couple people per week, you know, there's no question that that affects our ability to learn, to remember, to be present, and most importantly, to be happy.
Yeah, especially in the last few years, because isolation has been the thing that's, you know, quote unquote, kept us safe from COVID, that some people just never got out of that isolation.
That's so true. I mean, there's a whole crew. I mean, there were some really nice things about, you know, not having so many demands. I mean, I can certainly relate to that. And there were also some really awful things about that time. But you know, right, there is a whole crew of folk that are struggling to come out of that. And you know, sometimes you might want to talk to a professional, because social anxiety is real. There are absolutely techniques that help people to get through that. So it's important to try to get some help if you're experiencing that.
Yeah. And along with sort of these things that are going to help our brain, social connection, can you talk about, one, what is healthy self-care? I feel like self-care has turned into, you know, a bubble bath and all your problems will go away. But what does that really look like, and how does that impact your brain?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one thing I'll say that's important is what healthy self-care doesn't look like. And you brought up the scrolling earlier, which is such a great example, Cassie. I mean, one thing I often encourage people, just a good exercise, is to sit down and think of how you take care of yourself, you know? And for a lot of folk, it's the phone. It's, you know, just mindless scrolling, or, you know, trying to find the end of the internet, or alcohol, drugs, you know, getting through your day just for that glass of wine, which doesn't mean by any means you even have an alcohol problem. But if that's your one reward for the day, that is like a total neglect of your spirit. You know, that's just going to keep you in that Groundhog Day existence again. So recognizing what I call in the book false self-care, habits you might have to numb out and zone out, take the edge off, that really just kind of keep you stuck in the fog. But the alternative are really probably pretty obvious to anyone listening. But the point is, you need to like make a way to deliberately engage those things every day. And the block for most people seems to be what we were talking about earlier, right? It's like, I know I could go for that walk, but you know, where I am right now to that walk feels enormous. Like I can't imagine. And it sounds easy. It's not. You just got to do it. We wait for the motivation, but it's like, oh, I'm not motivated today, as if you're going to be motivated and then you'll do it. But usually, and the research shows us, it's kind of the opposite. Enact the behavior and the feelings will come later. So you just like will yourself to go on that walk, and later you'll be like, oh, I'm glad I did that. And that will help you to do it again and again. But yeah, some habits that need your focus that really are involved in getting out of the fog, certainly nutrition, you know, which is obvious, eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, drinking a lot of water, and certainly not eating, which is what we want to do when we're stressed out, right? Highly processed foods, excess carbohydrates, not enough protein, not enough fiber. It's just part of the brain, you know, wanting comfort, immediate comfort, which we totally get, but it again kind of keeps you in that fog. Totally fine to have some of those things. In addition, though, focusing on getting enough healthy stuff in your diet and water. I think people that are stressed out and overworked and fried tend to really just like sit at their desk or in their car and they don't eat, you know, hydrate properly. It's just like another thing that's like, oh, well, that's a waste of time. I'm not even going to think about it. But it really obviously does impact our brain and how we feel. Sleep is crucial. I mean, you know, sleep is probably almost like an epidemic right now. I mean, if the amount of people that struggle with insomnia or waking up in the middle of the night, and then there's a group of people that feel like they could just sleep and sleep and sleep. But any way you look at it, focusing on your sleep hygiene will make a big impact, which, you know, is probably pretty obvious, but just a couple words about that. Try to enact a ritual every night that is the same. And for most people, that means getting off screens at least an hour before you go to bed because of what we talked about with those dopamine hits, and they just keep the neurons like activated. So you want to just shut it all down and have some transition ritual, whether it's like a hot shower or some mindfulness, get some chamomile tea. Books are good because they just relax the brain. They're not as stimulating, but even TV would probably be better than, you know, being on your laptop or your phone. But going to bed at the same time every night is really important. And, you know, it's okay, you know, just even if you can't sleep, to just be in bed reading would be a great shift from being on a screen or scrolling every night. But going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, and having some ritual around that, whether it's a change of clothes, a hot shower, something that shows your brain you're downshifting. And as I said, exercise, everybody knows this, I think. And it's easy when we're stressed out and overwhelmed. What's the point of a walk? I got so much to do. This is ridiculous. And it's not, and the feeling most people have is it's not even going to really make a difference. I need to be doing X. It's like that perfectionistic thinking, like, what's the point of a walk? I should be, you know, running 5 miles. I'm so out of shape. I haven't been to the gym in so long. And then we just don't do anything. But a walk is hugely powerful. It checks every box for brain fog and anxiety. You go out, you look at nature, you're in the, you know, and it's winter where I am, at least, you know, it's really good to get outside in the winter, see the sunshine, breathe. And, you know, walking vigorously for 20 minutes releases those feel good hormones, endorphins, et cetera. There is nothing wrong with a walk. Sure, you try to increase it. Maybe only do 10 minutes today. Tomorrow, try to do 15, 20. And you can build upon that. But watch that perfectionistic thinking, right? It's like, that's not good enough. So I'm going to do nothing that keeps you stuck. So those are a couple of habits. Yeah. And certainly in anyone that can do some mindfulness meditations, that is huge.
It's funny. I've done what, like 28 of these interviews now, and no matter what the topic, what the issue, what the diagnosis, exercise, walking is always in our conversation.
And it's like so obvious, but it can be so difficult. Like we said, that feeling in our bodies just seems so the opposite of walking that we can't muster ourselves. But I think saying to yourself, yeah, I don't feel like it, and I'm going to do it anyway.
Absolutely. So now that we've gotten out for our walk, maybe we can progress to the next level of play. Can you talk about what that is and why it's important?
Play is a luxury, right? Like what we just talked about are kind of essential, drinking enough, nutrition, sleep, exercise. But play is something that when we talk about things that we get rid of when we're overwhelmed, like relationships and healthy habits, surely play has no part of our life, right? Like, whoa, there is no room for that. And I think for adulting in the United States means we got to be serious. We got to buckle down. We got to have those to-do lists. So people really give up the act of play, which is, you know, basically finding joy and pleasure, lightness, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't really have a goal or an outcome. It's not like doing ceramics so you can have a craft sale on Saturday, right? It's just doing ceramics because you like the feel of the clay in your hands, or having a great laugh with your friend, you know, that just totally brings you into the moment, or listening to comedy, or playing with your kids or a puppy, any of those things that just bring you pleasure for the heck of it. But there really isn't any other goal or outcome. That's the important part, you know, and as you're listening, just recognizing how much you do for a goal or outcome. For most people, it's all the time or they're numbing out, you know, got to drive my kids here, got to check this box for work, and then I'm in a zone. But play is like, no, I'm very present, right? I'm tickling my kid. Like, I'm very present. I'm alive. I'm in the here and now. And I don't have any goal other than just being in this moment. And there's something about that that is really good for our brains. And there's research on that. You know, even people that do, you know, word games or whatever, the elderly, that when they come back to a task, that they're better able to focus. When people, and maybe you even recognize this, Cassie, I'm sure most people have had this experience, like when you're really overwhelmed by a task you're doing, and then for whatever reason, you get pulled away from it by a good laugh or something hysterical or silly, that then you come back and you're like, oh, wow, no, I think I can do this. You know, it just sort of like shifts the brainwaves a little bit. And that gets into like flow state, and any way that we can be completely present, we're usually happier and we're usually better capable of doing the task at hand. So play can be really powerful. And most importantly, because we want to enjoy our lives. I mean, I work in the Washington, D.C. area as a psychologist, and it's, you know, very common that people are running their entire lives on work, and work for an office, work for their families or their kids, however it looks, but, and they hope for a vacation or an eventual retirement. And that really does keep you in a brain fog state of mind. You know, the present is all we have, and finding ways to bring levity and joy to your present day to day can make all the difference.
I think that's so interesting. And just my own personal experience last 3 years, I've continually like hyperfixated on a thing for a few months, like whether it be ceramics, I did that for a few months, or knitting or gardening or letter writing. And maybe it was my way of trying to find play. I was trying to figure out why I was doing this. Like, I was never a person who picked up a hobby, really focused, like bought everything I needed for it, and then just stopped and then moved on to something else. But maybe that's what my brain was looking for.
I think it is. I think it's like a craving to just like kind of, yeah, be whimsical, and those things are just for you, right? I was just going to share, I love this one piece I wrote in the book about this kind of Japanese toy machine that they have in Japan. I think it's called Gachapon or something, but it's like this, basically this vending machine of toys, like little miniature objects, like a little miniature phone or stove, just these like little silly things that are very cute that people like to get just for that reason. They don't do anything. They just think they're funny, and they collect them and they look at them. And it's kind of that idea of whimsy and being playful. You know, we need that.
Maybe that's the squishmallow phase for adults right now.
That's it. That's a good one. I'll have to use that example.
So now we've talked about ways that we can overcome the brain fog. But for someone who is really struggling, what's the very first step they can take?
I think the very first step is just like right now, if you're relating to all of this or some of this, I think just accepting that, because it's easy to live in denial, like it's fine. But if you're feeling this way, and like there's more to life than the way you're experiencing it, more peace of mind, more well-being, okay, that's awesome. Like, that's a great first step, just to be able to say that to yourself. And then the second thing is, I hope you really believe today that there is a path to get out of that. The biggest block to that path is usually that people stay in denial. They keep living that Groundhog Day existence. So acknowledge it to yourself. And it's like, okay, let's take some steps, you know? And then I would say the second piece is to really watch that self-judgment. It's just so defeating to the path of getting out of any behavior that isn't healthy for you, right? So, you know, when you recognize the self-judgment's coming up, so one way that might be is, I can't believe I've been doing this long, or what's wrong with me, or how did I let this happen, or I'm never going to get out of it. But really meeting that with compassion. We all have blocks. We all struggle. It's part of the human condition. But the key is that there is a path, and reminding yourself that you can come out of it with a lot of self-compassion. And then the third piece is to really make some kind of agenda. And I would say to try to bring in at least one of the things we talked about today every day. That would be a great start. Maybe you only do mindfulness for 10 minutes today. Maybe that's all you do. Or you just go for a 20-minute walk. Or you engage in a game with a friend or a family member. You know, but anything that just kind of brings you back to the present like that. And then try to build upon that. So ideally, over the next month, that you're building in two or three things a day that are about you and connecting with your sense of self. Oh, by the way, another example that we talked about was the social piece. You might just make small talk with a neighbor. Small talk is huge for brain fog. So we also think socially like, oh gosh, I have to invite all my friends out for dinner. No, just talk to your neighbor, your colleague for 10 minutes, again, about something that isn't like agenda focus, like, oh, did you take the garbage out? Or what are we going to do with the neighborhood listserv? But more just like, how are you? You know, what's up? How are your holidays? Just kind of be in the moment with that person. Volunteering is another great example that makes us present and gets us outside of ourselves a little bit. But engaging these things, as I said, once a day initially, maybe only 15 minutes a day, and then trying to build into two or three would be fantastic. Of course, another block is, like every human on the planet, you're not going to be perfect at that. There'll be days or weeks that you get off that path. But the key is to get back on, right? That's really the key with any new behavior, is to not beat yourself up that you got off and then just say, what's the point? Get back to that learned helplessness. I can't get better. I don't even know the point. No. Just get back on that train and it will pay off. It absolutely will pay off over time.
I think that's a really good spot to wrap up, unless you have any final thoughts for the listeners.
That is the final thought. Absolutely. Is just get back on that train and don't give up. And I mean, maybe the only other thought is to talk to people about brain fog and how you're feeling. I mean, that also checks a lot of boxes because people can relate and it's a way to connect and it kind of holds you accountable that you're saying out loud, hey, I'm going to work on this.
Definitely. Thanks so much, Jill. This was such a good conversation. I know I got a lot from it and I'm sure a lot of other people will as well.
Thanks, Cassie. It was a pleasure.
All of us struggle to find the get up and go we need sometimes, but when prolonged stress and anxiety begin to affect your ability to focus, concentrate, remember, solve problems, or communicate effectively on a regular basis, these symptoms may point to something more than just a stressful week. It's time to clear away the fog and reclaim your motivation, passion, self-worth, zest, and meaning in life. Based on cutting-edge research, overcoming stress-induced brain fog offers quick solutions you can put to work right away, including exercises based in awareness, mindfulness and acceptance, and self-compassion. With these 10 easily accessible tools, you'll find your way out of the haze toward clarity, improved memory, and a greater presence to enjoy life. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Join the New Harbinger Clinicians Club, a free membership club exclusively for mental health professionals. Sign up today and you'll receive a special welcome gift, 35% off all professional books, free client resources, free ebooks throughout the year, access to private sales, a subscription to our Quick Tips for Therapists email program, and more. Visit newharbinger.com/clinicians-club for more information. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.